everyone. This is your Captain Wade once again, coming from In the Dry Dock, and I'm joined once again by my executive officer and co-host, Will.
Welcome back, everybody. It's good to see you.
Well, today is a bit of a sad episode for both of us here on the podcast. It's an episode that I wish we didn't have to talk about in particular. I think you know what I'm talking about, Will.
Yeah, this might be kind of a downer.
Yeah, especially after our last episode where we were kind of really geeking it up on battleships and aircraft carriers and pocket battleships and all that fun stuff. This is the death of the ocean liner. And the death of the ocean liner is a divisive subject for most maritime history fanatics. We have just enough preserved ships from that era that it keeps the memory strong in the minds of those that see it. But we'll get to those in our ships of the week later on. But starting off with a bit of history, ocean liners, specifically on the transatlantic trade, would begin in earnest around the mid-1800s. The exact beginning is a bit spotty because there are different definitions of what constituted transatlantic passenger service on the river. The U.S. and the SS Great Western, both in 1837, began a tradition of setting speed records that holds today in the Blue Ribbons. Not Blue Ribbon, Ribband. That's a very key point. But anyway, to cut a long story short, the liner industry continued to grow from there, often with just as many disasters as triumphs. I seem to remember there were a number of cases that in the early White Star Lines history where they lost ships just from sinkings or fouling on rocks. I'm trying to remember the name of the ship that fouled on rocks near Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Oh, was that the Empress of Ireland?
No, it's not the Empress of Ireland, but that's another one that fouled up. But that was in the St. Lawrence Seaway, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. The Canadian Titanic, as they called it. Yeah.
I think it was the RMS Atlantic, one of the original ones. Essentially, they screwed up and they didn't know exactly where they were because the captain had never been to Halifax before. So,
that's not good.
Yeah, and the second officer had been, but he didn't listen and went to bed. And, well, they fouled up on rocks and the ship capsized within about 20 minutes. So not a good situation.
It was actually a Collins Line steamer, which is confusing because – and I got to check on this, but it's confusing because – it ends with the IC name, which is, you know, usually a White Star trademark. But I think that disaster kind of put that company out of business. And it wasn't until the Big U was built later that and I think the other deal was that the Collins Line was an American company. And so they had been setting speed records for a while, but it wasn't until the United States was built in 1952 that we got the record back after that. So that was a pretty big setback for the U.S. Merchant Marine when that happened.
Yeah, Marine had kind of, unfortunately, had played second fiddle during a lot of this period. You know, we got a few ships as reparations in World War One, and then built a few others. But it wasn't until the SS America and the SS States where we really were able to put our stamp on the transatlantic trade. But regardless, it's like I said, throughout the from the 1890s approximately, the liner trade really began to take off. And personally, one of my favorites is the 1899 Oceanic, technically the Oceanic II by White Star Lines reckoning. And she had a really short career because she fouled up on a sandbar, if I remember correctly, and bent her keel and all that. So the transatlantic trade and ocean liners, as much as we like to play up the idea of it being such a grand thing and always triumphal, I guess would be the word, it was a really dangerous journey from beginning to end.
Yeah, we even lost, you know, passenger ships in the 50s, like, you know, the Andrea Doria. So there were disasters, you know, all along the way, unfortunately. But, you know, ships did get progressively safer and better.
If you would mind, Will, giving us a little more of a history lesson from, say, about 1910 onward.
Yeah, sure. So the transatlantic trade really began to pick up around the 1900s with the introduction of really the first what could maybe be called superliners. Really the first ships that kind of maybe could be considered this were these four-funneled German ships. They built five of them. And then those were answered by two very famous British ocean liners, the Mauretania and the Lusitania, which set the Mauretania herself set a speed record that held from 1906, I think, until 1928, which was very impressive. And then after that, White Star Line responded with their famous trio, the Titanic, Olympic, and Britannic, the Olympic being the first and only successful one of the three. And then the Germans fired back. Well, Cunard, which was the other British company, responded to the White Star Line with the Aquitania. And then the Germans responded to that with what's called Bahlen's Big Three, because that was they were the brainchild of Albert Bahlen, who was in charge of the Hamburg America line. And that was the Imperator, the Vaterland, and the Bismarck. The Imperator was not su was supposed to be slightly shorter than the Aquitania. And so to get around this, they put a giant gold eagle on the front of the ship, stretching its talons out to grab the globe, which was not ominous at all. And it had a little ribbon around it saying, in German, "My field is the world." And so a lot of people at the time thought that this eagle was rather gauche, and it caused the Imperator to be top heavy. And so the ship rolled way too much. And eventually the eagle fell off during a storm, and then they decided not to replace it. But anyway, there was constant attempts to outdo each other with these liners, particularly before World War I. World War I kind of put a pause to it. The big three German ships were all handed out as reparations after the war. So the Imperator became Cunard Line's Berengaria to replace the Lusitania, which had been sunk. And then the Bismarck became the Majestic to replace the Britannic, which had been sunk. And then the Vaterland became the Leviathan, which became America's first big ocean liner. During the 20s, which is kind of odd considering that it was the roaring 20s and the economy was doing really well, they actually didn't build very many large ocean liners. They kind of kept the ones from before World War I in service. The notable exception being the Île-de-France, which became the flagship of the French line. And she was the first ocean liner to have what was called Art Deco interiors. That was a decorative style, which was dominant during the 1920s and 1930s. So she was a revolutionary ship and kind of set the stage for what would come next. At the end of the 1920s, the Germans decided that they wanted to kind of have a big comeback. And so they built two transatlantic liners, the Bremen and the Europa. And I'll take a second here to talk about something Wade mentioned, the Blue Riband. So the Blue Riband of the Atlantic was the award that was given out to the ocean liner or passenger ship that did the fastest crossing. And so it was always a matter of prestige to have the Blue Riband. So countries and companies would vie for it. And typically a company would try to get it, and then sometimes they would get financial support from their government. If they were trying to build a particularly grandiose ship to do it. And so the Bremen and the Europa were built with the express purpose of capturing the Blue Riband from the Mauretania, which they did successfully do. As an aside, the Mauretania put up a valiant effort to take it back, and she almost did, which was really impressive for a ship that was over
Wow.
20 years old by that point. She came within, I think, half a knot of taking the speed record back from the Bremen. So everybody was kind of rooting for the Mauretania at the time, but she couldn't quite do it. I think somebody said that the engines were literally like jumping off the bottom of the hull during her attempt. So anyway, the Bremen and the Europa kind of were the first in a new trend of true superliners that were built during the 1930s. And the next big one that came out was France's response to the Bremen and the Europa, the famous Normandy, which is some consider to
Oh.
be the greatest liner ever built. She was just incredible, and we could devote an entire episode just to the Normandy. I suspect we probably will at some point. But she was fabulous, innovative, had probably the greatest interiors ever put to sea. And the British response, which they actually kind of originated at the same time, these two were kind of competing projects that were started around the same time, was the famous and much honored and much loved Queen Mary, which had her first maiden voyage in 1936. And so the two of them actually traded the speed record back and forth a couple of times before the Queen Mary kind of cemented her control over it in 1938. And the Queen Mary, again, she herself could also get a whole episode. Out of all of the classic ocean liners from the pre-war period, the Queen Mary is the only survivor. She is a hotel and museum now in Long Beach, and I actually just went there yesterday. So that's pretty fun.
Lucky
I know. I was so lucky to get to see that. So anyway, a lot of these ships did not survive the war. I forgot to mention, in between the Bremen and the Normandy, another ship took the transatlantic speed record, and that was the Rex of the Italian line. That was the only Italian ship to ever take the speed record. A lot of the famous ships from before the war did not survive World War II. The Normandy was tragically lost through our own U.S. Navy bungling, which France has not forgiven us for. And then the Bremen was lost. The Paris was lost. The Rex was lost. The Conte di Savoia was lost. The Empress of Britain was lost. But anyway, some ships did survive. Both of the Cunard Queens, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, served in World War II. And Winston Churchill estimated that their efforts transporting troops managed to shorten the war by about a year. So that's just those two ships. So that's pretty impressive. After the war, there was another big boom in ocean liner construction because people were trying to replace tonnage lost during the war. The most notable of which came out in 1952. And finally, the United States had a true contender in the transatlantic, you know, trade. We had built a ship in 1940 called the SS America, which is much beloved by aficionados of ocean liners. But she was kind of a medium-sized ship. She wasn't quite big enough to take on the Queens. But the U.S. saw how effective the Queens were during World War II transporting troops and said, hey, we need one of those. And so, and again, this is a much longer story that could take a whole episode, but we built in 1952 the SS United States, which to this day is the fastest ocean liner ever built. She took the speed record by a lot. I think she shortened the Queen Mary's time by 10 hours. And although a, in my opinion, rather silly high-speed catamaran technically took the speed record from the United States because she had a grand total of two paying passengers on board in the 1990s, to me, the United States still holds the passenger service record. So anyway, we'll get into our ships of the week soon, but the bottom line is at the end of the 1950s, 1958 was considered the kind of the high watermark for the transatlantic trade. That was the year in which the greatest number of passengers crossed the Atlantic on ships. But there were already problems gathering and in the form of airplanes. And so the first jet flight across the Atlantic occurred that year in 1958. And after that, it was a long and steady decline for the ocean liner, primarily due to the fact that air travel was considered glamorous at the time, obviously not anymore. It was a lot more convenient and faster. And so we'll go into a little bit of what happened in the 1960s as the ocean liner gradually faded out. And eventually only a couple remained in service. And today there is still one ocean liner in regular service, but it's not like it was. So we'll go into our ships of the week next. We've got a couple of ships which we think kind of highlight this transitional period of what happened to the ocean liner. And both of them are classic ships that are much beloved by ocean liner fans.
Absolutely, Will. And I believe I'll take my ship of the week first because she somewhat predates yours, I would say.
Yep.
And this is, we haven't mentioned this particular nationality in terms of ocean liners, but they had their own niche and actually were quite prolific, which was the Holland America line, now often shortened to just the Dutch line. And this is of course the ocean liner company that came out of the Netherlands. And when you think about it, the Netherlands has quite a maritime culture, and it's not really surprising that they had their own contenders in the ocean liner trade. But they never really were as impressive as, say, even in the pre-war era, they never really were quite as prestigious as the British, as the German, even as the American offerings at the time. So the Dutch finally stepped up in 1906 and laid the keel on the Amsterdam. And this ship is just freaking amazing. There was a reason that she earned the nickname the Darling of the Dutch, the Ship of Peace. This was a ship that was beloved by almost anyone that set on her. A few stats about her, the size reference for her. She grossed out at 36,287 tons, but after her 47 refit, she weighed 400 tons more, actually. And she was 758 feet long and of 88 feet. So she was not a small ship by any means, not quite as big as say the Queen Mary or the SS United States, but she was no small potatoes at all. And originally she was supposed to have the name Prinsendam. Again, to any Dutch that might be listening, I really apologize if I'm getting this wrong. I'm trying my best. So anyway, Holland America Line kind of changed their mind and said, oh, we knew Amsterdam. Poke home the fact that this ship is going to be sailing from New York anyway, which was originally a Dutch settlement. Yes, New York was founded by the Dutch, if you didn't know that. But anyway, the liner was finished in, what was it, 1938. Yes, 1938. And from then on, she would become one of the most popular liners that would ever exist. Now, unfortunately, she only made 17 voyages before the outbreak of World War II. And she would originally spend about a year in what would be called, I guess, internship in the United States before the British actually, I guess you could say, rented her to be a troop ship alongside the Queen Mary, the Mauritania II, and the Queen Elizabeth. And these four ships really did an amazing job of getting troops where they needed to be. And didn't you say, Will, that Winston Churchill personally commemorated some of these ships as shortening the war?
Yeah, so Churchill said that just the Queen Elizabeth and the Queen Mary alone shortened the war by a year. And so then, if you add in all of the contributions of the other troop ships that were involved, the New Amsterdam, the Mauritania II, the Aquitania, and many others, that's a huge estimate because really what these ships did, a lot of people don't think about this, but the US was involved in D-Day, North Africa, the Italian campaign. You got to get all those troops over there to begin with. And so that's where, that's how this happened, was these ocean liners would carry massive amounts of these troops. In fact, on the record-breaking voyage, the Queen Mary carried 16,683 troops on one trip. So yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Now, the funny thing is that even during the war years, the New Amsterdam was popular among the troops for a few very key reasons that the Holland America Line had designed into her. Not only was she completely protected against fire, which was a big deal. Now, of course, the earlier Normandy all had a really extensive fire protection system, but that pooch kind of got screwed by the Americans who, D-d-d-d-d, we don't understand metrics. But anyway, the New Amsterdam also had a whole bunch of private baths. In fact, she had the highest percentage of private bathrooms of any ship afloat for her time. And this would also serve her well later on in her career. But anyway, she also had the largest air conditioning plant of any ship in the Marine at the time, which is pretty darn impressive.
Yeah, a
Now,
lot of
you
people don't realize that ocean liners in the classic era, most of them, if you were not in a first class cabin or even sometimes in first class, did not have private en suite bathrooms in their staterooms. You'd have like a shared bathroom down the hall, and a lot of them didn't have air conditioning. The queens originally were not fitted with air conditioning, and that became a big problem when they had 16,000 troops on board in the tropics.
yeah. Whew. Oh, the stinky I can imagine right now. Whew.
Yeah.
But anyway, the New Amsterdam, luckily, was fast enough, like the Mauritania II and Aquitania, that she could actually sail by herself. She did not need what was called you could call military escort. So she would finish the war. She would survive along with the queens and all the others. to begin her trade again in 1946 when she would be returned to the Holland America line. But the problem was is that she was wrecked. There was the troops had really done a number on her, the amount of use that she had gotten. Now she had a very, very modern interior, very Art Deco, but also lots of light colors that would often fool people into thinking that spaces were bigger than they were. So it was a really, really good look. Actually, I've incorporated this design into my own ships. I love the idea of making spaces seem bigger than they actually are. But anyway, the New Amsterdam would return to service after a massive refit, and this would involve, of course, the removal of all of her troop fittings, the special kitchens that she had, all the alarm systems, hammocks, and also the 36 guns that she had been installed with. So all of this had to be taken off the ship, and then also all of the furniture. All the furniture and decorations that she had been taken off at the beginning of the war because they're useless as a troop ship. So anyway, that was totaling 2,000 tons of furniture that had to be shipped from San Francisco, where they were basically stored by the U.S. government, to the Netherlands. The problem was is that a bunch of this stuff was in really bad shape after basically 5, 6 years of basically neglect. No one had paid much attention to these furnishings. So ultimately, about 3,000 chairs and 500 tables were sent back to their original builders and basically got the full refurbishment. And then a quarter of all the furnishings had to be replaced entirely. Unfortunately, the New Amsterdam had to have a lot of stuff done to her, including she pretty much had to have all of her machinery gone over too. So, and a lot of this stuff had to be hand-tooled, unfortunately, because the Germans had stolen or destroyed a lot of the Netherlands' industrial capacity. So they were pretty much starting from scratch. Anyway, at that so in 1947, October 29th, so not too long from now actually, after 18 months in the dry dock, the New Amsterdam finally service. And to the great delight of the people that would come to enjoy her. Anyway, the New Amsterdam would spend 20 years of, from 1947 to 1967, she would have nothing but essentially loyal customers and financial success. Even in 1959, when the Holland America line introduced the SS Rotterdam, the New Amsterdam still was the more popular of the two ships. That goes to show how great this ship was. She really commanded loyalty with people that wanted to go on her. But the problem was is that like Will said, right about 1958, the world started to change. And ultimately, the Holland America line chose with the New Amsterdam to operate her as a cruise ship. And like I said, her air conditioning power plant for this really came in handy for trips to tropical climates. And ultimately, the New Amsterdam, of course, by 1967, after her 20-year run of success, she was getting pretty tired. But the US Navy actually came to her rescue and actually replaced her malfunctioning boilers with US Navy surplus boilers. And these boilers were then installed over the course of about 16 weeks, and her career kept going. Now, unfortunately, her years were numbered, unfortunately. It would only take another 6 years for Amsterdam to be pulled from service, even from cruising, because the cruise was starting to really ramp up in the 70s. And Unfortunately, the New Amsterdam, as nice as she was, as loyal to her following was, it wasn't enough to justify her existence anymore. And it really went fast from there. In 1973, she's pulled from service, and under her own power, I love to point this out, under her own power, in 1974, she sailed to the ship breakers and was scrapped. And thus ends one of the most famous ships of the liner era.
Yeah, one of my favorite anecdotes about the New Amsterdam, Wade mentioned that her nickname was the Ship of Peace. And the reason for that was because when she was designed, unlike some ships like the Queen Mary, like the United States, which had kind of been designed with potential conversion to troop ship duty in mind, the New Amsterdam was purposefully designed to have no provision for conversion to wartime service. Now, obviously, that did end up happening, that she became a troop ship. And a lot of people don't really realize this, but after the Netherlands was overrun by the Germans, the rest of the Netherlands' overseas territories kept fighting for the Allies. In particular, Aruba and Curacao in the Caribbean provided a lot of our oil, and the Netherlands' East Indies kept fighting as well until they were overrun by the Japanese. And along with this, the Dutch Merchant Marine and the Dutch Navy continued to fight for the Allies. The Dutch Navy was small but significant. And their warships continued to serve the Allied cause. And the New Amsterdam kind of came to epitomize that. So, this ship, which was designed with no provision for war, the Ship of Peace, kind of stepped up to do her duty and serve the Allies. And so, for a lot of people in the Netherlands during the war, she was kind of a symbol of hope for the Netherlands because even though the country had been overrun, their great flagship was still fighting for them. And so she became a really important symbol during the war of the Netherlands' determination to be free again. And at the end of the war, Rotterdam was the home port for the New Amsterdam. And Rotterdam had been dastardly attacked by the Luftwaffe during World War II and had been bombed out. So Rotterdam was a mess. It was kind of a blackened shell of what it once had been. But the people of Rotterdam received a message that the New Amsterdam was on her way home. And so they all basically crowded the shoreline and the docks to try to catch a glimpse of their flagship coming back. And at this point, the New Amsterdam was still partially painted in her gray war paint, which was streaked with rust, but her funnels had been repainted in the kind of yellow, green, and white colors of the Holland America line. And on that particular day, there was a big fog bank that had kind of settled into the harbor in Rotterdam. And so everybody was kind of waiting anxiously for the New Amsterdam to arrive. And what finally happened was the New Amsterdam basically burst through the fog bank with all of her signal flags flying and an enormous Dutch flag flying above her. And then she blasted out this enormous greeting on her horn, which reverberated over the entire harbor. And supposedly everybody cried, is what I've heard. From that particular day, because with the day that the New Amsterdam came home was for many people in the Netherlands really the day that they really finally felt like the war was over. And so she had served her country well in war, and then as Wade said, she went on to serve for over 20 more years in peace. And so, and to many, she's also considered one of the most beautiful passenger ships ever built, both on the exterior and the interior. So the New Amsterdam is, you know, 5 stars, one of the best ships ever. My ship of the week kind of tells another part of the story of the transition from ocean liners to cruising. Before I do that, I'll just mention really quickly what the difference is, because some people are confused. I still hear people refer to cruise ships as ocean liners, which is technically incorrect. A ocean liner is a ship that goes on a set route that's a point-to-point form of transport. So that's like if you are trying to get from New York to England to Southampton, you would take an ocean liner and it would be a one-way trip. You could get a round-trip ticket to come back, but it was intended as a way to get you somewhere. Whereas a cruise ship is kind of a, let's just kind of sail around for a bit. And yeah, they do sometimes go to port destinations, but they usually end up coming back to the same place that they left from. And so the cruise ship is definitely done kind of as a vacation unto itself, whereas an ocean liner was used to get you somewhere specifically. And because of this different role, ocean liners were built differently. They were significantly faster than cruise ships, and they were much more structurally strong than cruise ships because they were intended to deal with long sea voyages, particularly the ones on the North Atlantic, had to be much more strongly built. So an example, the Queen Mary II, the only ocean liner currently in service, has about 40% more structural steel than an equivalent cruise ship. And most cruise ships today can go forward about as fast as the SS United States, the fastest ocean liner in the world, could go backward. So that kind of tells you something about the speed differential between ocean liners and cruise ships. So anyway, we mentioned the Île-de-France and the Normandie as two great French ocean liners. And the Normandie, which again, many consider to be the greatest ocean liner ever built, not without cause, I think they might be right, was tragically lost in 1942 in a fire. The United States had basically taken her over after France fell, and she was in the process of being converted into a troop ship called the USS Lafayette, kind of like how the Queens and the New Amsterdam were converted, when a fire broke out. And I believe, and I needed to check up on the details of this, but her fire control system, which was state of the art, was actually turned off at the time. And our U.S. Navy operators did not know how to work her fire control system. And
It wasn't even
tragically,
connected.
yeah, it was like completely off. Yeah, it was disconnected, which was ridiculous. And what the biggest tragedy of all of this is that Vladimir Yurkovich, the Normandy's original designer, was there. And he showed up and said, "I designed this ship. I know how to use the fire control system. I can save the ship." And they said, "Don't go away. You're bothering us. You know, this is the Navy. We know what we're doing." We did not know what we were doing. In the ensuing firefighting operation, so much water was pumped into the Normandy that she rolled over and capsized and became a total loss. So that was devastating to the French Merchant Marine and to lovers of ocean liners everywhere. So anyway, after the war, the Île-de-France was the only major French passenger ship to survive. And she was a lot smaller than the Normandy. And kind of as a consolation prize for losing the Normandy, the larger but smaller than the Normandy passenger liner Europa of the North German line, which we mentioned earlier in the podcast, was awarded to the French as a reparation, and she became the ocean liner Liberté. And so this was kind of a little bit of a restoration of the French line's pride, but most people didn't really consider the Liberté to be a proper replacement for the Normandy, especially since she was a secondhand German ship. But the Liberté and the Île-de-France carried the French line through the 50s. But by the end of the 50s, they were both aging out, and the French line was trying to figure out what to do to replace it. And so their original plan was to build two smaller 35,000-ton ocean liners. By this point, the airplane was starting to become a thing, and so people kind of saw the writing on the wall with the airplane. And so the French thought that building two smaller ships were less of a risk. But then in steps Charles de Gaulle, and he says, "Well, wait a second. We lost the Normandy. We've never had a proper replacement for the Normandy. I think instead of building two small ships, we should build one giant one, the longest ocean liner ever built. And this will be a big restoration of French national pride after the loss of the Normandy, and also to alleviate some of the issues that they were having with the ongoing Algerian War of Independence, which was going on at the same time." He thought it was needed as a boost. Also, a few years prior, the SS United States had taken the transatlantic speed record from the Queen Mary. And so de Gaulle thought that France maybe had a chance here to build an even better ship than the United States and take the speed record back for them for the first time since the Normandy had taken it. So, above the objections of the French Congress or Parliament, de Gaulle basically rammed this through that the French government would help pay for the construction of a 66 ocean liner, so way bigger than the ones that the French line were originally considering. And although she would be lighter than the Normandy because she was a narrower ship and had more advanced, materials, she would be longer. She would be 1,037 feet long, which would make her the longest ocean liner in the world, slightly longer than the RMS Queen Elizabeth, which up until that point had been the longest. So there were a few delays in getting the funding approved, but eventually the ship was built. She was launched in 1960 and was given the name SS France, both to commemorate the country itself and two previous French line ships that had borne that name. And so Charles de Gaulle gave a big speech when the ship was launched, and he said, "We have been given a new Normandy." And so for many, this was kind of the restoration of the French line to its full prestige that it had before the war. The France was rumored to have a top speed of around 35 knots. As
history would have it, she never did attempt to take the speed record from the United States. But she was a similarly advanced ship to the United States. She had the same level of fire safety, which you can imagine why the French would want to do that after what happened to the poor Normandy. From the outside, the France was a beautiful ship. She had kind of unusual funnels, which I know Wade is not a big fan of. The funnels had these weird wings coming out from the sides that were supposed to deflect the smoke away from the deck. It's kind of unusual. Her interiors were very, to me and to many people, they were kind of a disappointment compared to the Normandy, which had, you know, these gorgeous Art Deco interiors. The France's interiors were definitely kind of 16th century modern. So they were very up to the minute for the time, but they haven't aged as well as some of the classic ships did. But anyway, she did enter service in 1962. And to many, she's generally considered to be the last true great liner that was really solely built for the transatlantic trade. She had some provisions for cruising in the off season, but she was primarily built for the transatlantic trade. Now, around the same time, the British were also trying to figure out how they were going to replace the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, which were supposed to leave service later in the 1960s. And so they embarked on a long project, which went through several permutations. And eventually the ship was launched as the Queen Elizabeth II in 1969 is when she entered service. And so that ship eventually replaced both the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth. And so she and the France kind of became the last holdouts of the transatlantic trade. As we mentioned, aircraft travel was taking over as the primary way of crossing the Atlantic at this point. And so one by one, the great ocean liners were retired. The Queen Mary retired in 1967. The Queen Elizabeth retired in 1968. The United States retired in 1969. So it's kind of like a one by one, we're losing all the great ones. And so both when the France and the Queen Elizabeth II came out, they were kind of seen as almost white elephants. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you building these giant ships just when this whole concept is kind of going out? And so a lot of people saw the France as kind of the French line shaking its fist at the sky, so to speak, kind of a last final defiant hurrah before the ocean liner era would be over. As history would have it, the France remained in service until 1974 for the French line. So the fairly short career for a transatlantic liner. And the reason why this happened was because it was getting increasingly expensive to operate the ship. She was never sailing at full capacity. And the bunker sea crude oil fuel, which these ocean liners used, was getting increasingly expensive. And particularly in the early 70s with the energy crisis caused by OPEC, it got even worse. And so finally, the French government realized it was going to cost an extra $10 million a year to subsidize the ship. And they decided that money was better spent on subsidizing another transatlantic transportation project known as the Concorde, a supersonic airliner. And so they just moved their money from the France to the Concorde. And so then the French line decided that they were going to try to take her out of service, but her crew had other ideas. And so in a rare instance of this kind of thing happening on an ocean liner, in mid-ocean, her crew mutinied. And they took over the ship and demanded that the French line maintain her in service and give them a 30% raise. This did not happen. The ship ended up returning to Le Havre, France, which was where she was based out of. And she was immediately taken out of service and never sailed again under the French flag. She was towed away to a pier, which was kind of called the Forgotten Pier, and just sat there for about 5 years. And there were several schemes for what to do with her. One guy wanted to turn her into a floating casino off of the coast of off the Gulf Coast of America. Another person wanted to turn her into something else. There were a lot of different proposals for what to do with the France. But ultimately, what ended up happening was a gentleman by the name of Knut Kloster, who was the owner of the Norwegian Caribbean line, which later became the Norwegian Cruise Line or NCL, purchased the ship from the French. And his intention was to convert the France into a huge cruise ship. And this was considered a crazy scheme at the time because most cruise ships of the era were pretty small. If you've ever watched the TV show The Love Boat, the Pacific Princess, which was in that show, was kind of a good example of the size of cruise ship you'd be talking about at the time. They were all significantly smaller than the great ocean liners. And nobody had tried to really convert a true ocean liner into a full-on cruising role before. that did end up happening with the Rotterdam and then the QE2. I'll mention this. So the Queen Elizabeth II, which was the other kind of ship that was going on in this time period, she managed to make the transition work. She became a part-time ocean liner doing full transatlantic service during the summer months. And then she did cruising in the off season, and she managed to maintain this service until 2008, which is pretty impressive. In 2004, the Queen Mary II was built, which kind of took over that role from her. We'll get to that later. But anyway, the France was bought by NCL, was renamed the Norway, and was converted into a full-time cruise ship. And in the process, they made several modifications. They took out about half of her boilers so that she was more economical to operate, and she only ran on two propellers, so she was running much more slowly than she usually did. She was built with four propellers. All of the class distinctions between the first class, you know, tourist class, whatever on the ship were removed, and she became a one-class ship. And surprisingly to everybody, this ship became incredibly successful as the Norway. I will mention, too, that before she was on her last day under the French flag, they performed one final wedding on board the ship, which is kind of fun. But anyway, and that was actually, I believe, one of the NCL executives got married. Hmm. So anyway, she became very successful as the Norway. She entered service in 1980 as the Norway and became the largest and most prestigious cruise ship in the world. And she remained the flagship of the NCL cruise line until about 2003 or 2004. By the 90s, she was kind of getting outstripped by newer cruise ships. And so they gave her a refit. They gave her two additional decks of balcony cabins, which makes ship lovers like Wade and I cringe because it really ruined her lines, but they were really necessary for keeping her competitive. And they really did save the ship because a lot of newer ships had balcony cabins and they needed to be able to compete. So they did that. Eventually what ended up happening was the France suffered a boiler explosion, which kind of put her out of service for good. I think that happened in 2003. And that was really tragic. It actually killed eight of her crew members. None of her passengers were killed, but it did kill eight of her crew members. And that really kind of spelled the end for the Norway. But pretty remarkable that she had her initial kind of demise as an ocean liner in 1974. And then 30 years later, in 2004, she had still been in service as a cruise ship. So unfortunately, there were attempts to try to preserve the ship as usual when these kinds of things happen. But unfortunately, these efforts failed. She was renamed the Blue Lady. She was towed to Along, India, which is kind of the modern day ship graveyard. And she was scrapped starting in 2006 and ending in 2008. Incidentally, 2008 was also the year that the QE2 was withdrawn from service. QE2 had an interesting career. She wasn't immediately successful. She actually failed her builder's trials and had to be modified. But eventually she did kind of hit her stride, particularly after 1982, when during the Falklands War, she kind of echoed her predecessors, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth. She managed to serve as a troop ship during the Falklands War, and so she kind of carried on that tradition. In the 1990s, the Cunard line was purchased by Carnival Corporation, a mega company building cruise ship. They're not really known for excellent service, but they decided to build a new ocean liner to eventually replace the Queen Elizabeth II. And this was considered a crazy scheme at the time. Everyone's like, you're trying to build a new ocean liner in the 1990s? Are you nuts? This project became the Queen Mary II, which is the largest and longest true ocean liner ever built. And although she does, kind of like the QE2, spend a good portion of her year cruising, she does maintain a regularly scheduled transatlantic service. So that's pretty neat. The QE2 was retired in 2008, and then she was sent to Dubai to become a floating hotel, kind of like the Queen Mary in Long Beach. And she actually just opened in that capacity last year. It took about 10 years to make that happen because of the recession. So bottom line is, of the classic ocean liners, the remaining ones are as follows. The Queen Mary is in Long Beach, California as a floating museum and hotel. The Rotterdam serves in a similar capacity in, you guessed it, Rotterdam. The QE2 is in Dubai. The SS United States is awaiting restoration in Philadelphia. She's currently owned by the SS United States Conservancy, which is a nonprofit group that's trying to move her to New York as a museum and a multipurpose space. There's some promising developments with that right now. We'll see if they pan out. And then, interestingly, two classic ocean liners are actually still in service as cruise ships. One of them is called the Astoria. She was built as the Stockholm, a Swedish ocean liner. And her most notable thing was she accidentally rammed and sank the Italian ocean liner Andrea Doria in 1956. So she's actually rather infamous. And then, oddly enough, the other remaining one is called the Marco Polo. She's currently also serving as a cruise ship. But she was built as a Soviet ocean liner, the Alexander Pushkin, I believe in the 60s, and also remains in service today. They actually built five ships in her class. So anyway, there are several ways that you can see an ocean liner. If you're in the United States, your best bets, if you're on the East Coast, are to drive by the IKEA Philadelphia to see the SS United States. Or if you're in on the West Coast, pay a visit to the Queen Mary. But we're really lucky that we still have some of this heritage left. And then obviously the QM2 is in service as a true ocean liner. So there are still a few opportunities to experience this.
And if you're in the Midwest like me, then you actually do have an opportunity to see what you could call a lake liner, the SS Milwaukee Clipper. She is based in Muskegon, Michigan. And from what I've heard, she is well seen. But again, she was designed for the Great Lakes, so she is quite a bit smaller than, say the Queen Mary or the SS United States, but still a well worth visit.
And there's another one of those lake liners too, the Keewatin, which was a Canadian Pacific ship. She, I think, is either about to move or recently moved, so I've got to check on where she is now, but she is also on the Great Lakes. So
yeah,
lots of opportunities.
Absolutely. And I hope we can leave that on a positive note, because I am hearing the water coming into the dry dock. We are out of time for today. Will, it has been a pleasure serving with you today. And I hope to all our listeners out there that you have enjoyed this episode.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Fair winds and following seas. Goodbye.